Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 209. If you recall a few episodes back, 204 to be exact, we were introduced to the conflict between the sons of Mpande Kazanzangakona, Tetshwayo Kaimpanda, and Mbuyazi Kaimpanda. Mpanda had moved Tetshwayo and his Usutu regiments away from the northern power zones, and Mbuyazi and his Isixhosa to the southeast in an abortive attempt to reduce Tetshwayo's growing power. There had been a mock hunt organized supposedly to sort out the differences between the two, but the Isixhosa had melted away when they realized how many more warriors had pitched up to fight with Tetshwayo against them. It was in November 1856 that Mpande had made his move, and upon arrival in his new territory, Mbuyazi began throwing his weight around, provocatively clearing nearby homesteads and ordering the local clans to pay him tribute, eating up the opponents, as it was called. Many of the cattle he began to expropriate technically belonged to Tetshwayo. Mapito, who was advising Tetshwayo, suggested it was time to sort things out, finish and klaar. "You will never be king if you do not act at once," he told Tetshwayo in late November. Where Dingaan and Shaka had held total control over the cattle, Mpande had begun to lose his grasp over the AmaZulu nation. Senior chiefs Masipula and Mnyamana joined forces with Tetshwayo's brothers Ndabuko and Silwana, along with half-brothers Tabulumanzi, Shingana, Ziwedu and Hamu, and they marched to Tetshwayo's great place at Undini. There Tetshwayo plotted his next moves. He had the luxury of a bigger army, thought to number between 15,000 and 20,000 men. The odds were in his favour, but Mbuyazi was the nominated successor to Tetshwayo and obligated to fight for his honour. In the previous few years, Mpande had picked up an enormous amount of weight, and unlike Dingaan and Shaka, found it difficult to walk great distances. Tetshwayo used this against his father, visiting his mother's home at Kwaqikiza as regularly as he could. During each visit, he would show up at nearby influential homesteads and meet with the younger men of the Amabutu, emphasizing his position as a powerful leader, someone with charisma, highly knowledgeable about the ways of isiZulu culture and ritual. The Swazi campaigns had served to reinforce this perception. Prose poets sang his praises. All of this led to Mpande's switching allegiance, deciding that Mbuyazi was worthy, a response that I explained in episode 204. Mapita, who lived in southern Zululand, seemed to join with Tetshwayo, motivated more by personal ambition, and was running his Amabutu almost as an independent. It was easier these days to do direct deals with white traders than in previous decades. Mpande was finding it increasingly difficult to control these ambitious chiefs. During Mpande's reign, the royal grip on trade and traders was considerably relaxed. The greater degree of political autonomy enjoyed by the district chiefs gave them and their subjects an opportunity to barter directly with hunted traders without fear of retribution from the king. Thus, trade goods lost their aura of exclusivity as they became more freely available to the masses of the population. Not only did Mpande lose the monopoly on trade, but some Zulu openly exchanged royal cattle for trade goods, a development of which Mpande complained bitterly. Before 1856, this was virtually unheard of, but an event of staggering proportions was going to shatter the Zulu royal house. Tetshwayo formed up his Usutu regiments and proceeded to march south. Mbuyazi had panicked. He turned to white traders for help. He gathered up his people, men, women and children, as well as all his cattle and other livestock near Isanku, the mission station, run by Norwegian missionary Hans Schroeder. I mentioned him before. The man was 6 feet tall, powerful, with a very short fuse. He did not take too kindly to Mbuyazi arriving lock, stock and barrel at his mission station with Tetshwayo's imminent arrival at Isanku, which is near the town of Ntumeni. Schroeder was relieved when Mbuyazi continued south with his plan to cross the Tukela River into Natal, English territory. But it was early summer and the rains had begun. The mighty Tukela was already flooding, its yellow and orange waters leaping in giant swirling rapids, in places 5 meters deep. A hunter trader called E.F. Rathbone lived in a small house close to the Tukela Lower Ferry crossing point and was shocked when thousands of Mbuyazi's followers appeared at his home on the 23rd of November, 1856. Mbuyazi wanted Rathbone to provide firepower and support. Rathbone was aware of the AmaZulu royal house friction and also Cetshwayo's rising power. He wanted nothing to do with the politics of Zululand and sent a message to the British Natal border agent Captain Joshua Walmsley, warning of an impending crisis. The civil war that had been glowing hotly was about to burst into flame. Before the English authorities in Maritzburg could respond to Walmsley's message, Mbuyazi and two of his brothers managed to cross the flooding river and then formally requested protection from Walmsley and the British Army. All of this hullabaloo had reached the ears of one of the most important characters of the mid-19th century South Africa, John Dunn. His tale and those of his significant descendants will weave through our story from here on, and for good reason. He was a British trader, but had decided that the ways of the AmaZulu were more to his liking. Born in 1833, we believe, although no one is certain, and in Port Elizabeth, John Dunn arrived in Durban in 1838 with his father Robert, a Scotsman, and his mom. At least this is what we know based on his autobiography. The family lived in a part of Durban which became known as Seaview, close to Claremont suburb. Robert Dunn died when John was 14, then his mother died 3 years later. This personal loss sent the 17-year-old John Dunn on his trails, writing later in his autobiography how he had always been fond of my gun and a solitary life. In 1853, John Dunn finally made the decision to eschew the ways of the British and become fully Zulu. As he put it, he left for the haunts of large game in Zululand. There's a correlation between Dunn and one of our earlier characters, Coenraad de Buys. It involves lying colonials, those of their own caste, if you like, who swindled them, and both men decided the seemingly more honourable ways of the AmaXhosa and the AmaZulu were preferable to so-called civilised Dutch or British colleagues or family. De Buys was swindled out of his home after he was orphaned in the Cape. He never forgave his swindlers, and so too John Dunn. In 1853, he hired himself out to a local Durban entrepreneur for a trading trip up into the Hartveld, the Transvaal. Upon return, the entrepreneur, who is not named in Dunn's autobiography, refused to pay the youngster, saying because he was 17, he was underage, couldn't be paid. According to Roman Dutch law, no contract existed between them. Thus poorly treated, did John Dunn take off for the delights of Zululand, where men were men and swindlers were nervous. After some hunting and generally wandering about, he met British agent Walmsley, who needed an excellent translator. John Dunn spoke fluent Zulu. And so when Mbuyazi arrived with his brother, it was Dunn who did the translating. His preference for Zulu over English ways included a generous streak of ambition. Dunn offered to lead a group of 35 black Natal policemen across the Tugela to beef up Mbuyazi's forces. Dunn had been training these men in the use of firearms and horses and really believed he could make a difference. As you're going to hear, he was hopelessly mistaken. 100 African hunters joined this posse as it set out on the 28th of November across the flooding Tugela. Historians believe Dunn was motivated by self-serving motives. He did not care for Mbuyazi himself, but for the opportunity to earn himself a few hundred head of cattle, perhaps. A treasure indeed. This force of 136 men were instantly given a name, as is often the case in AmaZulu oral tradition. The Isinkobo, the Crushers, because of their firepower. They caught up with Mbuyazi's Isixhosa army at the headwaters of the Inyoni River. 2 days later, on the 30th of November, Cetshwayo's massive Usutu army hove into view. They arranged themselves on the low hills above the valley of the Umsunduzi stream and the upper reaches of the Mandani River. Cetshwayo now had 20,000 warriors at least, and facing this echelon of significance were 7,000 Isixhosa and 136 Isinkobo. Well, to be strictly accurate, a half dozen white hunter traders had joined Dunn on the escapade, along with a few Zulu assistants, so it's more like 160 Isinkobo. It became clear to Dunn that there would be no negotiations with Cetshwayo. The first bit of business, however, was not the Battle of Ndundukasuka, as it had become known, No, it was to try and get the five English hunter trader families who'd been blocked by the flooding to Geller across this thundering beast of a waterway before battle commenced. Their wagons and cattle could not cross, so they drove the machines and the animals across shallows to an island, while the women and children were ferried with some difficulty to the south side. On the 1st of December, Mission Critical had arrived. Cetshwayo could be seen through Dunn's telescope, ordering his Usutu horde into a semicircle prior to an attack. Dunn told Mbuyazi that his women, children and cattle should cross the river immediately or they faced obliteration. Mbuyazi refused, fearful of the fierce current. Matters took a turn when Mbuyazi's brother, Mantantanshiya, rounded on Dunn, accusing him of being a coward. The 7,000 Isikhoza were strong enough to fight off the 20,000 Usutu, he said. The die thus being cast, Dunn and Mbuyazi discussed the coming battle. Maybe they should go on the offensive, said Dunn, catch your much more powerful foe off guard. Thunderstorms then added a touch of drama to the late afternoon light, and both sides faced off. The women and children herded the cattle into the thickly wooded little streams and rills alongside the Tukela as the Isikhoza and the Usutu gingerly approached each other. An advance party of Usutu warriors made their way slowly into the open, and Dunn's Isingobo opened fire. No one was hit, and as darkness rushed in across the Tugela Valley, both sides retreated for the night. A misty drizzle pitter-pattered through the evening. The Isingobo warriors, apparently the more miserable of the two sets of soldiers, frightened by a number of false alarms that night. Early summer along the Tugela Valley can be rather contradictory. As the mists and drizzle cover the ravines and bush, it can be quite cold before sunrise. Zulu oral tradition and Dunn's biography are very much in harmony here, despite the terrible set of events that could hardly be called harmonious, which were about to play out. It is with some certainty that we can say that the Usutu were the first to move just before dawn, heading down the Mandini River Valley southwards. Cetshwayo stood along with his main chiefs on the western side of the Mandini River on a little hill called the Masomonka. On his head was a band of otter skin with tassels of blue monkey and a tall crane feather added to his regal regalia. It was the feather of the Utulwana. Some oral storytellers mention that he also donned a set of eagle feathers to complete the picture. Mbuyazi, to his credit, was unbowed. He stood on the Nkono Hill opposite Cetshwayo, southeast across the Mandini Valley. Cetshwayo wasted no time ordering his men to form up in the traditional war chest and horns formation. Mbuyazi knew that the most reliable warriors in this formation were in the center. Standing amongst the men of one of the horns, we're not sure which side, left or right, was Christian Groening, a young boer. He was one of only two men on Cetshwayo's side who carried a firearm. Mbuyazi drew up his Isingobo in the same formation with reliable men in the center. It was diamond cutting diamond, plus the firepower of the Isingobo, the crushers. There was always a moment before battle when something happens that is important for later storytellers, and this was no different. While the Isingobo chiefs gathered in front of Mbuyazi to receive their final instructions, a gust of wind blew his ostrich plume right off his head. His men saw this. A murmur went through the 7,000. This was a bad omen. At the same time, Cetshwayo seemed to sense the moment and took a shield that Mbuyazi had been known to carry, threw it upon the ground, and kneeled most deliberately on the hardened skin. The Usutu cheered at this gesture. Their prince had achieved supernatural mastery over Mbuyazi, calling up a wind to embarrass his enemy, then stepping on his shield. Victory was certain. Cetshwayo was aware that if he cut off Mbuyazi's warriors from their escape route towards the Tugela River, they would probably panic and flee. So he sent the right horn on a rapid trot in an attempt to get between the Isingobo and the mighty roaring river. Men of the Udlambedlu, the Utulwana, the Isindlodlo, and the Isankru marched in double time, swinging in a large arc towards the Isingobo left horn. Waiting and watching was Mbuyazi's half-brother, Shongweni, Mbande's son. Then again, the main players on this battlefield were all brothers or half-brothers, and all were Mpande's sons, except for John Dunn, the White Zulu. His men were positioned on the left flank with Shongweni, who ordered that everyone advance towards the oncoming warriors of Cetshwayo. They crunched into each other at the Nwaku stream, a tributary of the Mandeni River. The Usutu shouting, Usutu, and the Isinkoba, Laba, Laba, Laba. Shrill sounds of battle commenced, and although outnumbered 10-1, the Isinkosa threw back Quechua's first assault. The thunderous effect of 36 muskets had helped, but the Isinkoba were fighting with great courage. Quechua sent his Indaba Kawombi regiment from the center to bolster the right arm, but the guns of the Isinkoba and the desperate men of the Isinkoba threw them back once more. Was Mbuyazi going to achieve an almost impossible feat? While the right was thrown back, things were very different on Quechua's left flank. Here, there were no muskets to add firepower. It dawned on the commanders in the field that they should switch focus. The Sutu's best units, two of them, were moved from the center. The Mantlakazi at the front, with the fearsome leaders Mancheni and Sikizana. The other two men of note in this unit were the sons of Mapita, Hlomuza and Hayiyana. Behind them, the Zungu, the warriors of Tlechuayo's mother's people. These reinforcements plunged into the Isikosa, and Mbuyazi's men shuddered and began to wilt. Across the battlefield, the Isikosa left horn, recently victorious, lost courage, and retired quickly up the Nwaku Valley. There was a vague attempt at reforming, but the Usutu were coming on too quickly, and the Isikosa center collapsed. This was the moment that Quechua had waited for. His men of the Abakulusi, the Dloko, and the Izingulubi charged. There was a remarkable and symbolic last stand moment. Mbuyazi's center set fire to the grass behind them. A wall of flame shot up. It was a signal that they were going to fight to the death right there, their backs against the flames. That was the signal, but it didn't quite work out like that. Instead of standing to face their foe, many of the Isinkosa turned, holding their shields aloft. A new signal. Now they were formally surrendering. With that, they turned and, in a semi-orderly state of retreat, headed south towards the Tugela River. A measured retreat needs an orderly group of men to work together, fighting consistently so that their pursuers think twice. In the broken ground of bush and rock, and harried by the noisy Usutu, all semblance of order disappeared. Worse, their own women and children suddenly appeared in their midst, running with them. The rout, as John Labunt notes, turned into a massacre. It was 10 in the morning when the hunter traders sheltering on the island spotted the first Isinkosa sprinting towards the flooding river. Moments later, they saw John Dunn galloping towards the river. He turned to open fire on the Usutu. A mass of civilians, Mbuyazi's people, flooded over him, the cattle lowing and stampeding. It was too late. The Usutu were thorough. They spared no one they found. Running through the bush came the portly Mantantashia, the man who called Dunn a coward, begging for him to pick him up on his horse. Dunn realized that his steed could not take the overweight chief's mass and left him to his fate. Soon some of the crowd pulled Dunn's horse to its knees and he leapt off, stripped off his shirt and dove into the Tugela. He swam to the ferry boat, which had stopped midstream, and was hauled to safety. Most of his Isinkoba, the crushers, were not so lucky. They were killed. The Usutu reached the terrified hunter traders on their island. Their wagons were plundered and 1,000 head of cattle carried off, but they were left alive. Quechua had ordered that they not be killed. He didn't want the English authorities to turn his Zulu victory into a political headache. Meanwhile, E.F. Rathbone had been marooned at a small house on the wrong side of the Tugela. Groups of Usutu began to appear, their spears thick with blood. They greeted him with smiles and went on their way. He was not the enemy. Hundreds of Isikosa were hemmed in on the Tugela bank and in front of the Usutu, behind them the flooding river, and the crocodiles, which had begun to zone in. They smelt blood. Some of the survivors ran downriver towards the confluence of the Mandini. Hundreds were slaughtered in the hollow of the Tambo stream below a hill, the Ndulundi. That's very close to the town of Mandini today. Quechua was now with his warriors, taking part in the coup de grace. We don't know how many men, women or children were slaughtered in the Battle of Ndondokasuka, but at least 2,000 warriors died. The total number of Mbuyazi's people who perished was in the many thousands. Mbuyazi and 5 of his brothers died in this terrible battle. Mantantashia, who had laughed in the face of danger, Madumba, Shongweni, Somklawana, Dabulasinye. For the next few weeks, bodies washed up on the beaches, swept down the flooding together, deposited on the sand of the Indian Ocean. Cetshwayo suffered many hundreds of casualties himself. Later, a missionary in Empangeni stepped out of his hut to witness the Usutu pass, driving their looted cattle. Behind them came the injured, terrible, gaping musket wounds. In Natal, word of this disaster came quickly, and just as quickly the refugees. There were so many that the authorities passed what they called the refugee regulations. At least 4,000 passed into Natal from December until early 1857, along with 10,000 head of cattle. So by 24 years of age, Cetshwayo had become one of the most powerful men in Zululand, after his father Mpande. By the end of that year, 1857, negotiations between the king and the upstart prince led to Cetshwayo agreeing to keep the peace in exchange for a sizable chunk of Mpande's territory. Despite all of this, the unstable nature of Zulu politics meant that Cetshwayo was not certain he would become king. In cultural terms, he was still referred to as a boy because the Amabutho he commanded directly, the Utulwana, had not received the king's permission to put on their head rings. That was the moment boys became men in the eyes of the people. Many others also eyed the throne, none more so than Hamo Ka Nzibe. That's a story for episodes to come. Next, we gallop back to find out what was going on across South Africa circa 1856-1857. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load updates about various episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, Salagatli.